Ending 99-0821, Lambreth versus State of Kashmarsik. And how long did I get? Close enough? Close enough. Okay. We'll first hear from Eric Darling, Attorney Darling, representing Ms. Lambreth. Mr. Darling.
And please, the court, counsel, good morning, everyone. I am Eric Darling, and I represent the plaintiff and appellant in this case, Arlene Lambreth. Now, as everyone is aware, this case presents a res ipsa issue, which is probably somewhat refreshing, given a lot of the complex cases that come before the court. But it's no less important. And in that regard, it more specifically relates to the interrelationship between res ipsa loquitur and the defense that the Wisconsin jury instructions describe as the illness without forewarning defense, often known in common parlance as the heart attack defense. Specifically, when you're presented with a case which, as a prima facie matter, seems to present a fairly straightforward set of facts, giving rise to a basis upon which to conclude that a particular defendant was negligent. When the defense then comes forward pursuant to its burden of proof and puts forward a defense that an illness without forewarning, in this case a heart attack, is what caused the accident and therefore alleviates the defendant from liability, how do those two burdens interrelate with each other? And to what extent is the defendant entitled to summary judgment and the ability to deprive the plaintiff of a jury trial when the heart attack defense is limited to that? Now, in that regard, I've got a confession to make, and that is that until I got involved in this particular case, it would have never occurred to me that what, as a prima facie matter at least, seems to be a fairly straightforward automobile accident case would even implicate res ipsa loquitur. Put another way, if you've got a simple fact pattern where, through eyewitness testimony, a plaintiff isn't able to establish that the blue car ran the red light and collided into the side of the white car, to what extent are we dealing with a case that implicates res ipsa versus to what extent are we dealing with a case which involves very direct evidence of negligence? And quite frankly, before I got involved in this case, I don't think it would have occurred to me that I would need to get knee-deep in the res ipsa cases to ultimately determine the appropriate outcome.
Counsel, as a threshold matter, maybe I'm wrong. It seemed to me your reply brief was a little bit different in emphasis than your initial brief, and that you were evolving on this res ipsa matter.
Thank you.
That's why, but I note that you never raised res ipsa. It wasn't pled, not that you have to plead it, but you didn't plead it. You didn't argue it. But res ipsa came into this case in a motion for summary judgment brought by the defense. And that kind of feeds into the reason I raised that is because you're saying you never would have thought of it. And indeed, you didn't think of it. And in your reply brief, you seem to be suggesting, well, maybe this isn't a res ipsa case. Maybe this is an illness, unavoidable.
Illness without
forewarning. Sudden illness, sort of. When I was reading this case, all along, I thought of a case we had, I think, last term, Totsky. One of the reasons I always called that case Trotsky, and I don't know if it was Totsky. And it's a different case, no heart attack. But in that case, there was a bus driver, black ice. Are you familiar with that case at all? You don't have to be for my question. Okay.
Then I'll admit that I'm not.
Okay. But essentially, I mean, there are different issues. There was the emergency doctor. But what you have can be argued is, in that case, violation of the safety statute is negligence per se. Raises a presumption of negligence that has to be rebutted. What's the violation of safety statute in Totsky? The violation of safety statute in Totsky is they go into an intersection below a stop sign, obviously. Why aren't you arguing that this is violation of the safety statute, negligence per se, a la Totsky? It seems to me that going through the intersection, which is actually what happened in this case, because Marchick went through the intersection, your client was heading south in a different road, went through the intersection, and so you have violation of a statute, negligence per se, which is a presumption, which can be rebutted. And the rebuttal can be, in Totsky, it was Black Eyes Emergency Doctrine. Here, arguably, it can be rebutted, heart attack, you know, sudden illness without warning. But why conceptually isn't this violation of a safety statute equals negligence per se, which is rebuttable? And of course, the big difference is, if it were that, there would be no chance, there would be, this would not be a summary judgment case at all, and you wouldn't lose on summary judgment. But the way that the case is framed in res ipsa, they're arguing, it's argued, and the trial court found that you have a burden rather than a burden shift. So tell me why this isn't a violation of the safety statute, negligence per se, a la Totsky.
First of all, let me say, I don't know absolutely that it's not, but as a structural framework for my argument, that's obviously not where the case has been up until this point. The essence of the distinction that you raise seems to be the difference between violation of a safety statute, which we commonly refer to as a presumption of negligence or negligence per se, whereas res ipsa has historically been referred to as an inference, as opposed to a rebuttable presumption.
Yeah, well, the big difference, I mean, those are nice words, but the big difference is who has the burden. In a presumption, it can be rebuttable, and therefore it goes to the defendant. In a permissive inference, arguably, there's no rebutting to be done. It's a pure permissive inference. There's no argument to be done. But when you then put in the third element of res ipsa defined in Peplinski, which you have to show substantial, sufficient evidence in order to be entitled to it, that puts an initial burden on you if you go under res ipsa that you wouldn't have.
Well, absolutely. And I, as a plaintiff, I obviously have an initial burden in every case. And I think you're correct when you say that in certain cases there's a significant difference between a presumption and an inference in terms of whether or not it shifts a burden to the defendant. But I think if you look behind that distinction, you'll see that it is a distinction which is probably not all that material in this case, because even the cases dealing with inferences clearly say that if you present evidence sufficient to support the inference, you have presented evidence sufficient to support a plaintiff's verdict, or put another way, you have made out a prima facie case. And in either instance, it's then up to the defendant. And with regard to an inference, I guess the defendant may choose to rest, and the trial court may not be have an obligation to direct a verdict for the plaintiff, whereas with a presumption, I guess they would. But the issue in this case is, in either case, have you made out the prima facie case? And in either case, is it therefore inappropriate to grant summary judgment to the defendant when the only thing that's been brought forward vis-a-vis the summary judgment motion is a heart attack happened, we don't know when? Historically, the way we got into res ipsa in this case, and I'm probably making an admission here, is that the cases that seem to deal with this issue, and they go back more than 100 years, all seem to be steeped in discussions of the res ipsa inference. There's obviously quite a few cases that have been cited in both briefs, although I would point out that there's really only two that would meet my definition of an illness without forewarning case. That's the Wood case and the Doing case. Now, does that mean that at this stage of the evolution of these kinds of issues, that this court couldn't take a different approach and treat this as a violation of a safety statute case? I don't think so. My evidence is fairly straightforward. The defendant's vehicle collided with the rear of one car, then grazed a second car, and then ultimately invaded the intersection and collided with the side of our client's car. Does that constitute a violation of a safety statute? I think as a prima facie matter, you've clearly got evidence there that would support such a conclusion. But at the same time, I don't think the defense is going to come back any less in that instance and say, well, yes, but we still have illness without forewarning, and argue that potentially we're risking too much jury speculation here. Well, we're never going to know which came first, the heart attack or the accident, and
but
therefore...
But you see, the difference I'm saying is, depending on what doctrine you pursue, and one, you, the focus is on you.
I think the focus is on me and both, quite frankly.
Well, if you show violation of the safety statute, the presumption then goes, and there's a burden that's placed on the defendant. If you go under res ipsa, then you have to not only show control, and this is the type, you know, the normal prima facie things, but then the third thing you have to show is the sufficiency of evidence. And that's what we all hear about, is that third prong, whether or not you're showing sufficient evidence, that brings us to this court.
That's correct. And I think that the basis of our appeal is that we have clearly shown sufficient evidence, because we have clearly shown evidence which, separate and distinct from the defense evidence, which is, let's admit it, the heart attack. That's when the heart attack comes in, when the defense puts on their case. Absent the heart attack evidence, does our case present sufficient evidence to go to a jury? If so, summary judgment is inappropriate. Summary judgment was granted in this case. So while I appreciate that there is a difference between the presumption associated with a violation of a safety statute case and the inference associated with res ipsa, I think for purposes of addressing whether or not summary judgment was appropriate, in either case, it's simply not. Now, I make this technical point of law about whether a case involving eyewitness testimony that the defense vehicle ran a red light or ran a stop sign or rear-ended a vehicle without explanation, etc., not simply to make a technical point, but rather because I think it's important in terms of the kind of cases that are being cited here.
Mr. Darling, let me, if I might, interrupt you at this point. You're talking about the evidence that was presented, and I'm interested in what was presented before the trial judge on the motion for summary judgment. I assume there were portions of depositions, there were portions of what else? Depositions from three doctors or affidavits from three doctors?
It was deposition testimony from all three doctors, I believe.
What else was presented to the trial judge?
What else was presented, and again, this was of course, was a defense motion, was essentially the police report. Police reports obviously set forth the officer's findings with regard to statement of witnesses, with regard to physical facts, etc. I think for purposes of this appeal, the question of whether we even have a sufficient record could be raised, but I think the answer is, again, this was summary judgment methodology. This was a posture where the defense obviously carried the burden. The defense obviously carried the burden that if we look at all the evidence, and even in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, we simply don't have a basis to go forward. That was obviously the defense argument. And what the defense relied upon in that regard, and at that stage of the game, what we had was expert testimony from the medical doctors, which was primarily confined to the question of whether or not, on autopsy, etc., there was any way pursuant to pure medical science to say, well, the heart attack preceded the impact, or as opposed to the impact induced the heart attack. That was the only deposition evidence that we had.
Am I correct that two of the doctors basically said that the heart attack preceded the collision, and the third doctor said we can't really tell?
No, I would characterize it this way. The ex-medical examiner, who was the medical examiner at the time, but was ex by the time that his deposition was taken, went out on that limb, and that's my word, and determined that he was able to conclude through some evidence that the heart attack must have preceded the initial impact. However, there were two defense medical doctors, and the other defense medical doctor, on the confined issue of whether or not you could, pursuant to pure medical science, determine that issue one way or the other, admitted what we consider to be the obvious, and that's that you just can't do that. You can't do an autopsy and say, well, I can tell from some physical finding here which came first. And of course, the plaintiff's medical expert reached the same conclusion. So the score there would be two experts, one plaintiff and one defense, concluded that there was no way to tell. The second expert, the other defense expert, determined that he thought he could. However, again, we obviously have to review this evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And so I think for purposes of the issues on appeal, you have to throw out that testimony, focus on the best case scenario here.
As I understand the testimony, that there was a question of whether or not this person could control the vehicle. In other words, whether he had any ability, whether the heart attack was just before, and I was looking at your opposing counsel's brief, that it's a question of whether or not he could have controlled whether he had the heart attack before, during, or after, right? Isn't that the issue?
Well, that goes to two issues, and there's actually a second issue on appeal, which was not only given short shrift in the trial court, it was basically ignored in the trial court, and that was that the illness without forewarning defense is only available to a defendant who cannot be charged with negligence for either getting behind the wheel in the first place or continuing to operate the vehicle when they should know better. And there was a second issue there based on some testimony obtained from one of the defense medical doctors to the effect that this isn't a heart attack that just knocks you cold. This is the kind of thing that there will be 20 seconds, I believe, was the testimony or so of symptomology. And the question was, well, why wouldn't you pull over? And the defense medical doctor's answer was, well, you would hope that they would. And one of the issues we raised in opposition to the summary judgment was, separate and distinct from this res ipsa versus illness without forewarning issue, don't we have a second issue that needs to go to the jury? And that's namely, even if the heart attack preceded any impact, is there some negligence associated with failing to bring the vehicle to a stop? Judge Kiefer did not even address that issue. By virtue of granting the summary judgment motion, he inferentially rejected it, but nothing in his decision from the bench or any of the orders really even addressed it. The other issue about controlling the vehicle and whether the vehicle was being controlled goes to other physical evidence, and that's the fact that the police report notes skid marks after the first impact and before the second, I believe, and or after the second and before the third. And one of the issues that our expert doctor raised is
that expert's name was?
Dr. Engel, okay, was the plaintiff's medical doctor.
Did you raise in front of the trial court the issue of negligence and simply getting behind the wheel in the first place?
We didn't raise the getting behind the wheel in the first place because it just does not appear that this gentleman had a medical history that would have supported such an argument. So the secondary issue that I just referred to wasn't so much getting behind the wheel in the first place. Uh-huh. It was this question of what kind of symptomology is it more likely than not he was experiencing in the seconds prior to, if in fact it happened this way, in the seconds prior to getting to a point where he simply was unable to control the vehicle. That issue was raised, and that is the one which, in my opinion, was essentially ignored by the trial court. On this issue of skid marks,
you were answering the question about non-medical testimony other than did it happen before or after. You were saying the skid marks after the first, then not, you talked about the 20 seconds. Then you talked about the skid marks after the first but preceding the second. I wish if
sure.
You could continue on with that answer.
What this goes to is what I feel is the undeniable fact that we've, to a certain extent, got a public policy issue before the court today. And the public policy issue, as the defense wants to characterize it, is, hey, if you've got a case where all the jury's ever going to do is guess about whether the heart attack caused the accident or the accident caused the heart attack, we don't want to send cases like that to the jury. That's bad public policy. The public policy issue, as I would characterize it, is that's not all we have. Just because as a matter of pure medical science, the doctors can't do an autopsy and say, oh, I can tell which came first, doesn't mean that that's all the evidence that there is in this case.
Okay, that's what I get. What else
do you
have?
This, and the doctor that the plaintiffs retained pointed out that while you can't determine the pure medical question, you can look at other things and base a decision, a jury verdict, in terms of probabilities and likelihoods, on the overall evidence. And the overall evidence wasn't just what the autopsy shows. The overall evidence was obviously what the eyewitnesses will say about speed and distance and movement, and what the physical facts will show in terms of skid marks. And one of the specifics, to answer your question, that Dr. Engel referred to, was the fact that this car was leaving skid marks after the first impact, which is at least implies that the driver may have been attempting to control the vehicle after impact, which would be, certainly a juror could conclude, more consistent with the idea that the heart attack perhaps hadn't yet happened or was just beginning to happen at that point in time. Another medical point that Dr. Engel brought out, which I've described as more of a general medical issue, is that we were using, excuse me, the shorthand heart attack, but the particular medical event that occurred here was of a type that is uniquely associated with the sort of adrenaline rush that one would likely experience after having a car accident. A jury could hear that. A jury could take that into consideration when trying to decide the ultimate question of which came first. And so we're not deciding a case such as this in a vacuum, simply because of the fact that as a matter of pure medical science, you can't do an autopsy and determine one way or the other which came first. It's clear that if the evidence in this case were identical, except you change one thing, instead of determining that this gentleman died of a heart attack, we determined that he died of the traumatic injuries he sustained, not only would we have a case which would go to the jury and on which the plaintiff would probably prevail, we've got one where the plaintiff might even get a directed verdict, because then we'd simply have a car, rear-ended car number one, grazed car number two, and collided with the side of car number three. Nobody's arguing that that case can't get to the jury or that that case wouldn't likely result in a plaintiff's verdict. It's only the heart attack evidence that brings us here today. And the public policy question, obviously, before the court is, why do we deny this plaintiff her day in court simply because the defense is able to say somewhere during this accident process, or perhaps in the immediate aftermath of this accident, this gentleman suffered from a heart attack?
Why shouldn't we just say, look, you got two innocent people here, the man who suffered from a heart attack and ran into all these cars, and the people who could do nothing about it. Why don't we just say, get rid of this rule about the heart attack and illness, just say, between two innocent people, we have to impose it on the person who caused this, even if it wasn't fault.
I certainly think asking that question looks the public policy issue squarely in the eye. And while probably I wouldn't want to argue that there should never be the potential for arguing to a jury the question of whether illness without forewarning should relieve a defendant from liability, I think the public policy issue that you raised is front and center in this particular case, because we're not arguing whether or not the defense should be able to argue this to the jury. We're arguing about whether the plaintiff should even be able to get the case to the jury. And of course, it's our position that it was simply not the correct approach to say the medical evidence is inconclusive on when the heart attack occurred, and therefore I have to throw the whole case out.
Well, would you agree that if it was only the medical evidence and the medical evidence was balanced, that you really couldn't tell whether the heart attack preceded or was subsequent to the crash, would you say then it doesn't go to the jury?
If all we had was the medical
all
evidence,
we had
and
was
nothing
two
else.
Doctors both say can't tell.
Well,
it's another way of saying, of asking Justice Bradley's question, isn't that this really that case? And you don't have very much else, if anything else.
I don't think this is that case, no. I think you've got plenty. And I'm not saying that this is the most fact-filled case that's ever going to come down the pipe, but I do believe that you have plenty in this case. And from experience, I believe that we submit issues such as this where it could credibly be said, boy, this one's a toss-up, to juries every week of every year.
Well, then, it sounds to me, like if you go back, well, it sounds to me here like you are essentially conceding the res ipsa issue, that this is not a res ipsa case. And that seems to me your argument here is really what we've got here is enough evidence to prove negligence, or at least enough to go to the jury.
No, I'm not conceding the res ipsa issue. I started out by suggesting that it was somewhat surprising to me to learn how steeped in res ipsa these cases are. But now that I understand it, I do believe that it is a res ipsa case. I believe it is a case that presents an event that seldom ever happens in the absence of negligence. Well,
can you have both simultaneously?
Can you have a res ipsa case and a case yeah. involving direct evidence of negligence? I think the Paplinski case would say probably not, because the Paplinski case talks about not only cases where the plaintiff proves too little, but cases where the plaintiff proves too much.
Right.
And maybe the issue in this case is, should it go to the jury on direct evidence of negligence, or should it go to the jury as a res ipsa case? But the trial judge obviously rejected both and concluded that it was neither, and that summary judgment for the defendant was appropriate.
And all
that's
you,
what brings us here today.
And all you need is an opinion saying that there's a material issue of fact that goes to the jury. And what's the right? That
among defeats, other things, yeah.
That, well, that defeats
that's probably
summary
all
judgment.
I mean, sure.
That defeats summary judgment. So just concisely state what the issue of fact is.
The issue of fact in this case is whether or not the heart attack evidence as presented by the defense is sufficient to support an illness without forewarning defense. And the issue of fact ultimately is whether or not the heart attack preceded or came after. The issue of fact is all over this record, and the issue of fact is there as the basis to deny summary judgment.
Why do you even throw in the issue about whether it preceded, whether the heart attack came before or after? Because as I remember you arguing 20 minutes ago that if it came before, he would have been, but you could at least have an argument to the jury that he had plenty of time to pull over.
Well, and that's a subset of the illness without forewarning defense. It goes to the question of, even if you've otherwise got facts which give rise to the illness with forewarning defense, which I would always argue is an issue that's got to go to the jury, but even if you've got that, you also have as a secondary issue the question of whether there's some negligence associated with either starting down the road or continuing down the road in the first place. There are two separate issues, although obviously related to one another.
And the burden of proof is always on you to prove negligence, negligence in causation and damages.
And the res ipsa cases show that burden is met by presenting evidence sufficient to give rise.
The burden is always on you.
Yes.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you. You have several minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Knudsen, you have argument time representing the estate.
May it please the court, I am Sherry Knudsen. I represent defendants, respondents, American Family, and the estate of David Kaczmarzyk. Also with me is Mary Lee Ratzel, a colleague of mine, and Elizabeth Kokel from American Family. The way that this issue came up in the trial court and the way it's been briefed in both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court is as requiring the court to interpret the third requirement for the res ipsa loquitur doctrine. And the argument of the defendant in our position has been that plaintiff has proven too little because the evidence has given rise to a non-actionable cause, a possible non-actionable cause, and it's just as likely that the non-actionable cause was the cause of the accident as the actionable cause. And there's no evidence in this record to allow the jury to make a logical decision between the actionable cause and the non-actionable cause. Now, there's been some questions asked about the non-medical evidence, and from what I heard today and from reading the briefs, the non-medical evidence we're talking about is the skid marks and the lack of erratic driving before the first collision.
And, counsel, just to opposing counsel indicated there were witnesses. Are you throwing that in the mix, or was that included?
So well, there's been no affidavits submitted from any of the witnesses, and there were no depositions taken. So the only thing that would be in the record is the police report, which does have some discussion of what the eyewitnesses said. And I am, in a way, including that because there's nothing that the eyewitnesses said that would include anything beyond lack of erratic driving.
Well, counsel, what about this? The witness that would be car number two, the first one with which there was impact, said that he was going westbound, car number two was going westbound, and he looked in his rear view mirror, and at that point he saw a dark colored vehicle coming up from him, behind him very fast. He could not tell if the driver was trying to shield his face from the bright sun or if this was the visor from the vehicle that was whipped down. In any case, then there was impact from the vehicle. I mean, arguably, I'm not saying any of this is correct. I'm saying, though, arguably, you could present a case where this witness testified to what's in the affidavit that was submitted in summary judgment, consistent with it. And he says this. He says, I'm driving along just like this. Car, I see the car in the rear view mirror. It's speeding. No erratic driving. The officer first at the scene, the other officers then took all of their measurements after the accident, showed no skid marks before the first accident, but skid marks, which would, I'm now saying this on my own, skid marks which indicate an attempt to bring a car into control. Now, that last sentence is my own, but I'm saying, you know, that's an argument that skid marks are indicative of that. In fact, I think that was referenced in one of the depositions of the doctors. There's a showing of control, which is consistent with one of the doctor's testimony that it could have happened after impact, that is the accident, because of the accident, there's this adrenaline rush and you can have heart attacks. I mean, I'm not saying any of that's true, but I'm saying, boy, based on what that witness said, that there was, you watched him come up behind him, and there was apparently no attempt, and he was speeding, and there was no attempt to stop, and there was a visor, and he couldn't tell if he was trying to, you know, keep the bright sun out that day. Apparently there was trying to shield his face from the bright sun, it says, or if it just came down. It was impact, then there was heart attack, then you've got the 20 seconds of trying to keep it under control. No, I'm just reading all of these different things to suggest to you that I suppose it's plausible. I don't know. Why not let the jury decide?
Assuming that all of those things were true, the problem in this case is that there is still no evidence of causation. There's nothing to tie up these things, this evidence that possibly could lead to an inference, or not an inference, but possibly could be evidence of negligence, and tie that up with the accident. You're still left with the same problem, that it's equally likely that the accident was the result of the arrhythmia as it is that it was the result of this negligence.
Well, in this framework, you know, I always kind of smile at this case and think of, you know, what caused the accident? Well, everyone knows who caused the accident and what caused it. It was the vehicle. I mean, my senses were talking about whether it was a non-negligent or negligent cause. And in one view, it might very well be negligent if the guy, I'm sorry, Mr. Kosmarchuk, was speeding, didn't bright sun, didn't see the car in front of him, hits the car in front of him, then goes into a heart attack, but still is in this 20-second period testified to, and obviously is displaying signs of control of a vehicle because brakes are being apparently intermittently applied. Like I said, I'm not saying that's true, but boy, it seems to me that that might be enough to get by this total even scale of don't know if it happened before or after. I mean, those are indicia of it happening after the accident.
Well, the experts considered that evidence, and the testimony of Dr. Engel was that he was not able to form an opinion on whether the arrhythmia occurred before the first collision or after, and then he testified it would be speculation for anyone to say when that occurred. Yeah, and the testimony of the defense experts, specifically Drs. Wicki, was that that evidence was not inconsistent with her opinion that the arrhythmia preceded the first collision. That when you have an arrhythmia, although you're not able to have sufficient control to pull the car over, you may be able to apply brakes, and it's such a sudden onset that there may not be evidence of erratic driving. So there's nothing to link up this possible evidence of negligence with causation. And that's the problem. Causation remains in the realm of speculation in this case. That's why summary judgment was appropriately granted.
Well, counsel, so you think there's no material fact in dispute?
Correct.
And you think there's no material fact in dispute because you think all the evidence shows that, shows what? That he had a heart attack before he hit any of the cars? Does the evidence show that beyond dispute?
No, but I think that's a red herring.
Okay. Tell me why.
Because when you're considering the Russ Ipsa case, it's the burden of the plaintiff to come forward with some evidence that it's more likely that negligence was the cause rather than the non-actionable cause. And even outside of Russ Ipsa cases, for example, in the Merco case, decided in 1978, that was not framed in the framework of a Russ Ipsa case. Russ Ipsa never came up in that case. However,
that the alarm system?
Correct. And you wrote that decision.
I remember it well.
However, the determination was made that judgment needed to be entered in favor of the defendant in that case because it was equally likely that the negligence was the cause of the injuries as it was that it was a non-actionable cause.
Yeah, the issue which we keep going back to is whether these witnesses, the witnesses or the skid marks could be interpreted differently, and that would raise the issue so one theory might be more likely than the other, or a jury might believe it.
Counsel, did you answer the question?
Well, the other problem with the skid marks, it's not within the common experience of jurors to determine, well, because they're skid marks, that must mean that this driver had the heart attack or arrhythmia, more properly called, after the first collision. That's something that requires expert testimony. And there is no expert testimony in this case that because there were skid marks, it's more likely that negligence was the cause of the accident than the non-actionable cause.
Counsel, is a disputed issue of material fact the following, that the symptoms of this kind of heart attack is invariably a 20-second warning or more that it's coming on. The person knows it's coming on. In other words, what I'm getting at, obviously, is what if 10 doctors, and you can't, 10 doctors all testify that this guy had 20 seconds to know what was happening to him. And you don't have any medical testimony that says that's wrong. Is that a material fact in this case?
Well, I don't believe there's a dispute on that issue. The testimony of Dr. Engel was that when Mr. Kaczmarczyk experienced this arrhythmia, it was a matter of seconds before he died. And the testimony of
Then isn't it really an issue of material fact as to whether or not he was negligent in failing to respond in those matters of seconds that he had to get his car out of the zone of danger?
There is no evidence to suggest that he had sufficient time to pull his car over or somehow avoid this accident. Dr. Zwicky testified that he would have had perhaps a matter of seconds, perhaps 20 seconds. It's speculation. And Dr. Engel also...
Why is that speculation? If a doctor tells the jury that this gentleman had 20 seconds to act, and then Mr. Darling argues to the jury, he had 20 seconds to act, and the failure to act in that 20 seconds constitutes negligence.
Is that a hypothetical? Because that's not the evidence in this case, that there was 20 seconds for Mr. Kaczmarzyk to
A matter of seconds,
respond.
Or as Dr. Zwicky, I guess, testified, up to 20 seconds. I mean, I don't understand your case here. It seems to me that's a perfect issue for the jury to decide.
But it's still within the realm of speculation as to whether he would have had sufficient time. We don't know that it's 20 seconds. Mr. Kaczmarzyk wasn't wearing a defibrillator at the time. We don't know how much time he had. It could have been 1 second. It's completely speculative. The jury would be basing its decision on conjecture.
But what if the medical evidence is that you always have 15 or 20 seconds? I mean, we haven't reached that point yet where this medical evidence has gone in yet, have we? And the plaintiff is entitled to all reasonable inferences.
The plaintiff could have submitted an affidavit from his expert saying that in cases where someone experiences an arrhythmia, they would always or generally have 20 seconds to respond, where they would have full control and be able to pull their car over to the side of the road on a busy road in Waukesha. But we don't have that evidence, and the plaintiff had the opportunity to present that evidence. All we have is testimony from Dr. Engel that either cause is equally likely.
Counsel, this is, of course, at summary judgment stage, and the good old days may not be either good or old, but I remember in the good old days, the way that if you had 15 or 20 seconds, this is what you would do at trial, not at summary judgment. You would ask the court to take judicial notice of the Department of Transportation braking stopping distances, and the court then has an instruction, and again, I'm not sure this is, I'm not trying to parrot what the law is now. I remember this is the way that it was done a few years ago. So that's the way you would do it. And then the braking stopping distances of the Department of Transportation would say something like average perception reaction time of 1.5 seconds. And then there's a chart that says if you're going 30 miles per hour, you're going 44 feet per second. You have a braking distance of 43 feet, a perception reaction distance during that period of time, you'll go 66 feet, for a total stopping distance of 109 feet if you're going 30 miles an hour. I mean, that's the way that the evidence would come in. Maybe there's some case law that has changed that kind of presentation at trial, but it seems to me that's kind of possible if you have 15 or 20 seconds.
We don't know that Mr. Kaczmarzyk had 15 to 20 seconds. There's no evidence to support that. The testimony of plaintiff's own physician, their own expert, said that it would have been a matter of seconds and he would have died. The testimony of our expert was that he would not have had sufficient control to pull the car over. That's what the evidence is. And to say maybe something else could have happened or other evidence could be there, the plaintiff had every opportunity to bring that evidence in the summary judgment motion. This was actually the second summary judgment motion filed. So we just don't have that evidence.
So what kind of decision would you write, Ms. Knudsen? How would you handle this case so that it's a meaningful case for the entire state dealing with race ipsa and the concept of illness without forewarning?
The race ipsa issue, I think it would be very helpful for the court to expand on the third requirement that the plaintiff not prove too little. And what we know from the cases Klein, Bars, Mattson, and Wood is that where the evidence gives rise to a conclusive possible non-actionable cause, and there's no evidence from which the jury can make a logical decision between the non-actionable cause and the actionable cause, res ipsa does not apply. The second part of this decision is that plaintiff has not come forward with sufficient evidence to remove causation from the realm of speculation, and that's why summary judgment was appropriate. The plaintiff has to come forward with some evidence of causation to indicate that it's more likely that it was the actionable cause, it was the negligence that resulted in the collision, and that does not exist here. Plaintiff failed to remove causation from the realm of conjecture, and therefore, according to cases like Merco and even the Recipsa cases, summary judgment is appropriate.
Counsel, can you bring me to a point that I think is, that's, to me, important? As I looked at these cases, and you cited a number, and your opposing counsel cited a number, there appeared to me to be two strains of cases, and then each of you tried to distinguish the others. In large part, your line of cases, one of the major ones or the culmination, is the Wood case, and you argue about that. Does Wood stand for the premise that if an accident like this involves a heart attack, that res ipsa is not available?
No.
Okay, tell me what the premise of Wood is.
The premise of Wood is, first, there has to be conclusive evidence of a non-actionable cause. So let's assume we have conclusive evidence of a heart attack at some point during the accident. The second part is that there's no evidence from which the jury can make a logical decision between the non-actionable cause and the actionable cause. Now, there very well may be a case where the driver experiences a heart attack at some point during, after the collision, and there's still some evidence that would allow the jury to make a reasonable choice between the two. If this, it was a case where the defendant had a heart disease that he knew of, not our case, but a hypothetical case, that would be a case where res ipsa would still apply. So there's really two parts.
If you didn't have that knowledge beforehand, that's a separate and distinct, if you will, cause of action, that you negligently got in the car as opposed to negligently driving. I just want to know and make sure I understand what you believe the breadth of Wood to be. There's a lot of discussion about that language in Wood. Is it in the footnote? No, it isn't in the footnote. But it's, it kind of says it's arguably dicta, and you're going back and forth whether or not it was central to the holding or dicta or not. But the language that, you know, even if it had been before, you know what language I'm talking
yes.
about, the sentences. I mean, I got from the focus of both parties on that language and you relying on that language that it doesn't make any difference if it's before or after or during, that the heart attack involved in an auto accident would negate any res ipsa claim vis-a-vis negligent driving. So help me with that if I'm wrong.
Okay. completely irrelevant when the arrhythmia occurred or the heart attack occurred. But what that Wood case is saying, that it's not the defendant's burden to prove conclusively that the heart attack preceded the collision. Because when you're looking at whether res ipsa applies, you're looking at what has the plaintiff shown us. So you're focusing on the plaintiff, not the defendant. If the plaintiff had some evidence to establish or tending to establish that the heart attack occurred after the collision, then res ipsa would apply. So timing could be important, but it's focusing on the plaintiff's burden, not the defendant's burden. And all Wood is saying is that the defendant does not have to conclusively prove the heart attack occurred before the collision in order for res ipsa to be inapplicable.
And what amount of evidence does the defendant have to show in this case that the heart attack occurred after the initial impact? I mean, the importance of the timing is, if it's before, it's, you know, an act of God, it's not my fault, I'm not negligent. If it's after, classic res ipsa, the type of accident or situation that doesn't happen unless there's some negligence. So what burden does the plaintiff have in this case to show, if it goes the route that it went after, to show that it went after? What's the standard of proof?
It's some evidence, enough to tip the scales, enough to give the jury something to base a logical decision on, to say, yes, it was negligence. And so it could be expert testimony. It could be eyewitness testimony that the driver was reading a map, smashed into a car, got out of his car, and clutched his heart. There could be different kinds of evidence, but it just has to be some evidence.
My recollection of the Peplinski case relied on a 1992 case for this quantum of evidence, which we relied on, that is Tutenwald, or some starts with T-U-T anyway.
I know what you're talking about.
And there they put it in the negative. There was no evidence, and that wasn't acceptable. So the case then took that language. In fact, Peplinski cites that language, quotes that language, as does the 1992 case, and says no evidence isn't acceptable. But what is? Is it just some?
More likely than not, because that's really the whole rationale for res ipsa. There's no evidence, direct evidence of negligence, but because of the way the accident occurred.
It can't have more likely than not. Because then, more likely than not is, for instance, a preponderance. That's another way of saying it. 50-50, more likely than not means over 50, that means a preponderance of evidence. Then you're saying that the plaintiff has to show by a preponderance of evidence, which means actually the plaintiff hit a home run, because the plaintiff's going to win if you can show by a preponderance of evidence. He has to show by a preponderance of evidence in order to get a res ipsa inference. That just seems inconsistent. In other words, he's got to get a home run in order to get an inference to get the first base. And so it doesn't seem like that's the right amount. Maybe the something that you talked about earlier is the right. What's the standard?
Well, the standard that, if you look at the treatises on res ipsa, it's not that the plaintiff has to eliminate with all certainty all other causes. All that's needed is some evidence from which a reasonable person could find it more likely than not that negligence.
Then they get to the more likely than not. Then they're already home. You know, what does the plaintiff need to get $1 million at the end of this case? After it goes to a jury, he has to show it's more likely than not. So how can you have that as the threshold to entitle him to use res ipsa? He doesn't need res ipsa if he can show it's more likely than not.
But it does have to be some evidence upon which a reasonable jury, if it accepted that evidence, could make a logical determination that negligence was the cause.
Counsel, I want to raise the question of this burden of proof. You assert that it's on the plaintiff here in your answers to Justice Bradley. But is it really when, in fact, the defense, and what you are relying on, is a heart attack?
You were relying on the illness without forewarning, correct?
No. We're not relying on the illness without forewarning defense.
Well, it seems to me that you're saying that it isn't it clear that if the heart attack occurred before the first striking, there's obviously no negligence because of illness without forewarning. If it occurred after the accident, then you don't have that, do you?
Correct.
Now, the jury instruction on illness without forewarning has a comment. And although we don't normally take the ALR second, you're aware of what I'm talking about,
yes,
aren't you? That the party asserting the defense of illness without forewarning has the burden of proof to establish it. So if, in fact, the evidence is equal as to whether the attack occurred before the first striking or after it, it seems to me like you have failed to carry your burden.
That's the same confusion that the Court of Appeals had, and it's a very difficult concept, but because we start off with, is there any direct evidence of negligence or even circumstantial evidence of negligence? And the decision of the trial court in our position is that there is not. I'm sorry, causal negligence. I need to clarify that because it's really causation that's lacking. And if you accept that premise, then the plaintiff has to rely on res ipsa. And if you look at res ipsa, it is the plaintiff's burden to establish it. So that's almost a threshold issue before you get into the defense burden on illness without forewarning. So if you're looking at that threshold issue, because we're focusing on has plaintiff produced any evidence on an element upon which it bears the burden, we come to res ipsa because there's no evidence of net causal negligence, and res ipsa plaintiff bears the burden. They have to show that there's sufficient evidence to bring the issue of causation out of the realm of conjecture, and that's what they have failed to do. So the focus in this case should be on the plaintiff's burden. It should not be on the defendant's burden. You should not have to reach the issue of illness without forewarning.
The plaintiff didn't assert a heart attack. You did.
I'm sorry?
The plaintiff did not assert heart attack, right? I mean, the plaintiff's facts are Mr. Kazmierczyk's vehicle struck car 1, which struck car 2, which struck car 3.
But it's undisputed that Mr. Kazmierczyk had an arrhythmia, and if the undisputed evidence or the conclusive evidence shows that there's a possible non-actionable cause, then it's the plaintiff's burden to show that that there's some evidence that the jury could make a decision that it's the negligence as opposed to the non-actionable cause.
Well, I have a little problem with the burden, too. In the civil jury instructions on res ipsa, the burden of persuasion doesn't shift from plaintiff to defendant, and it is error to so state. In Dewing versus Cooper, which is a 1967 case, court says, however, once having introduced evidence that the defendant driver crossed into the wrong lane, the defendant driver has the burden of going forward with evidence to prove that such invasion was non-negligent. So that's just the burden of going forward. Is that how you read that? Non-persuasion?
Yes.
So the burden of persuasion is always on the plaintiff here.
Right. That's correct.
So what does that comment mean on the illness, that you have the burden to show, to establish illness without forewarning?
The way I understand it is that it's been interpreted as an affirmative defense upon which the defendant would bear the burden of proof.
And you say it's not your defense in this case.
No, that's not our defense. We focused on, does the plaintiff have sufficient evidence of causal negligence? And we say no, there's no direct evidence, there's not sufficient circumstantial evidence, and res ipsa does not apply. We're focusing solely on the plaintiff.
Why can't we say the plaintiff here has evidence that the defendant driver crossed into the wrong lane? Well, here the evidence is he just smacked into this car. And without more, smacking into three cars, which is what happened here, would appear that with the driver having full control and the other car is not moving, let's say, that raises an inference of negligence, right?
The, pro- problem with that...
Okay.
The problem with that is that...
Sounded okay to me.
There's still no evidence of causation.
Causing what?
I'm sorry?
I mean, we know what the cause is. The cause of the damage to Ms. Lambrecht is your client's car hitting her car. That's causation. We know that. Now, what there isn't evidence of is negligence. That's what we're missing. Right?
Causal negligence.
You have negligence causing damage. We have damage, right? And we know that the hitting was causal. Now we have to see if there's negligence that's causal. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's find negligence. I mean, that's one of the first things we have to find.
Okay.
All right. So the plaintiff says, I've shown negligence. It's unexplainable that a person is going to hit three cars unless the person is negligent. Sleep, that's negligent. I mean, surmise it. Drunk driving, that's negligent. Not watching the road, that's negligent. You know, we don't have to prove which of those it was. We have now shown under res ipsa that there's an inference of negligence. I, as plaintiff, have done everything I need to do. The ball is in your park, as I understand it, to go forward with evidence to prove that it was not negligent, right? So now the burden of going forward shifts to you. So what do you say?
Well, that's assuming res ipsa applies, and we're saying it does not apply. Now, if you assume it applies, yes, then the burden of persuasion shifts.
No, not burden of persuasion. Going forward with the evidence.
I'm sorry. You're correct.
That's very important.
You're right.
You're better off not having the burden of persuasion.
Correct.
Okay. So what do you say?
If this court decides that res ipsa applies, then it's fairly clear under the law that summary judgment can't be granted, just as if a res ipsa applied in a case, directed verdict could not be granted. So our position is that res ipsa does not apply because of looking at the Klein and the long series of case law. There's a conclusive possible non-actionable cause in the evidence, and it's just as likely that the non-actionable cause resulted in the collision as the actionable cause.
But you have to show the non-actionable cause, don't you?
Well, we have to show conclusively that there's a possible non-actionable cause. That's the language used in Wood, and that's very important.
Fine. And what is your possible non-actionable cause?
The arrhythmia. It's uncontested.
That's right. So you come in illness without forewarning.
No, it doesn't shift to the illness without forewarning defense. We're still, if you look at the case, the Klein case, the Bars case, Mattson, Woods, they still talk about the fact that you have to look at what the plaintiff has proven. You have to see if there's any evidence between which jury can make a logical choice between the two. And in the Klein case, there was no evidence that that the possible non-actionable cause preceded the collision. The same is true in the Bars case. I see that my time is up.
Your time is up, Ms. Knudsen.
Thank you.
This is a difficult case. Grasp, at least for me. Mr. Darling.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I got to admit that I'm extremely surprised to hear the argument put forward today that the defendant's case does not involve in any way, shape, or form the illness without forewarning defense that we see summarized in the Wisconsin jury instruction. I think it's number 1021. I guess it was never affirmatively stated one way or the other in their briefing, but it's certainly the first time that I've become cognizant of the idea that that's the approach that the defense is taking. What we've been struggling with is this. The inference of res ipsa seems to say that it's not a presumption, it's an inference. And therefore, as a technical matter of evidentiary law, the burden of proof does not shift to the defendant. However, the res ipsa cases do make clear that once you have demonstrated the evidence sufficient to give rise to the inference, the plaintiff has made out a prima facie case. Has made out a prima facie case in the sense that whether the defense goes forward or not, we've now got a case that can go to the jury, and we've got a case which, if the jury decides for the plaintiff, will be supported by the evidence, namely the evidence that gives rise to the inference.
So while the burden of proof doesn't shift in the sense that the defendant will get slam dunked, if you will, by the court if it does not go forward, a prima facie case has been made, and that goes to the illness without forewarning defense. To say that this case does not inextricably involve the illness without forewarning case, I think, is incredible.
Well, counsel, I guess I've seen a lot of things that are incredible, so maybe my threshold is different. This returns me right where I started, the first question I asked you. My concern is that that our state of the law not be who creatively thinks of raising a race of first because of this. See, the defense is saying, look, we don't have to do this illness without forewarning. That's an affirmative defense. Nothing about that. Our focus is whether res ipsa even applies. And we're saying it doesn't apply, so we don't have to worry about rebutting it. We don't have to worry about any verdict. That's where they're coming from. But they can come from that direction because this case is cast as a res ipsa, which puts a showing upon you of some standard, whether it's some or sufficient or more likely than not, I don't know. If it were cast in a different way, that the defendant went through the intersection, which violates a safety statute, making negligence per se, then the law is they do have to raise this affirmative defense, or they are probably out of luck. So I don't want it to be who gets to the courthouse first, who gets to define the issue in summary judgment first. Tell me why this is a res ipsa case rather than the other kind of case that I just described.
First of all, let me state for your benefit, Justice Bradley, that the next time I get a case like this, I may well cast it differently.
I need to know that.
It is a res ipsa case, and if there's anything I beat my head over on this case, it's perhaps looking at it in a too oversimplified a fashion, but it is a res ipsa case because the defendant's car collided with three other vehicles that have absolutely no negligence of their own.
Let me cast it this way. Why is this not a negligence violation of a safety statute equals negligence per se case?
I don't know that it's not. I can't answer that.
And if it's both, then we got problems.
Well, I think if it's the one, then all these res ipsa arguments become a moot point, quite frankly. If it's negligence per se, and negligence per se may never overlap with res ipsa, then it's not both, but it doesn't matter whether it's both, because once you've got negligence per se, you don't need to concern yourself with res ipsa. Perhaps that's a Piplinski proved too much case. But I wouldn't be here today if the allegation was that I proved too much. I lost at summary judgment. That's why I'm here today.
Also, I don't understand your argument, frankly, because if you say this is a res ipsa case, then why isn't every case involving one vehicle striking another, which strikes another, res ipsa?
I'm not sure that they're not, and that takes me back to where I began. Absent an admission by the defendant driver, I was fishing around for something in the glove compartment and I wasn't watching where I was going, or perhaps some testimony from a passenger of the defendant driver's car to that effect, it may well be, although I certainly in my everyday practice haven't in the past looked at them this way, it may well be that every car accident case that simply involves eyewitness testimony of those outside the vehicle relative to how the vehicle operated as opposed to relative to what the driver was doing inside the vehicle is, as a technical matter, a res ipsa case. It's just that in 99% of those cases, we don't concern ourselves with that fact because that's good enough. The reason we're so focused on it in this case is because then, and only once I've rested, then does the heart attack evidence come in. And that's the point here. The undisputed heart attack evidence is not in the case until the plaintiff has rested.
Okay, maybe we could get at it this way. Is there any direct or circumstantial evidence of negligence here on the part of the defendant driver?
There is the rear-ending of car number one. There is the grazing of car number two. There is the leaving of skid marks.
But you know, the only way you get there is by res ipsa. The only way you can say those that amounts to negligence is by the invocation of the res ipsa doctrine, right?
What I'm going to do is what I did in my reply brief and what I've done here today, and that's hedge my bets to a certain extent and say that it's either res ipsa or it's direct, and either is enough. That's my answer.
How is it direct evidence of negligence?
It's direct evidence of negligence in the same sense that if a client comes to me and says, the driver of this particular car rear-ended me at a stoplight and he's now fled the jurisdiction, that is direct evidence of negligence. I think of that as direct evidence of negligence. I will never hear from that driver because perhaps he died in the accident or perhaps he's fled the jurisdiction.
You're saying if you hit a car that's standing still, by definition, that's negligence.
That's prima facie evidence of negligence in my everyday way of thinking, yes.
Because if you were careful, if you had your eyes open, you weren't speeding, you would have stopped. But you didn't, and you hit something that was stationary, that's negligence.
In a nutshell, that's it. And obviously the...
It's a matter of common sense, but maybe that's what res ipsa is. It's common sense.
Right, that's the definition of res ipsa.
Exactly.
And I'm willing to concede that this case may be reliant upon res ipsa, but I'm not willing to concede that that is in any way, shape, or form fatal. Res ipsa, once the elements are there, is for the jury.
Right, I understand it, but that's a different question than I asked. So you concede the point that your opponent made in oral argument that there is no direct or circumstantial evidence of negligence here, that this is the only way, I mean, this whole case rises or falls on res ipsa. And
the only problem I have with your question is to my understanding, res ipsa is by definition a rule of circumstantial evidence. So to say that there's no circumstantial evidence of negligence is, to my way of thinking, another way of saying you don't have a res ipsa case here. And I'm saying at the very least I have a res ipsa case, and that's why there is this circumstantial evidence.
Well, with those words, sorry, Justice Brasser.
There were two cars ahead of this striking car, and then the car coming through the intersection. Is that right? Well, why were the cars, they were stopped? Were the cars stopped or were the cars moving?
I believe they were moving. They were prior to the intersection, but they were moving. In fact, I think they may have been in an extended right turn lane or something like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Darling. Thank you, Ms. Knutson. That concludes our argument. We will have our third argument at 1:45 today. In the interim, the...